Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 16th, 2012. If I asked you the best way to bulletproof your personal finances, what would you say?
Having a savings account, having your money for retirement saved, and having a plan for yourself 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years down the line.
Stick with college, get your education, try to find a career that can be able to help you.
Take out a certain amount of money from my paycheck every month and put it into a savings. And I also pay all my credit cards off in full every month.
I'm a little bit younger, so I've got a significant amount of my savings in more risky investments like the stock market. I do try to keep about a 1 to 2 month expenses cushion in my savings account.
All good habits, but what if the entire financial system collapses or your whole house blows away? This hour, in collaboration with the New York Times, a special report, Bulletproofing Your Finances, on Marketplace Money from ABM.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
Are you prepared for the worst? Do you know exactly what your insurance policy covers? Can your stock and bond portfolio withstand another financial crisis? Do you have a will in place? This week, we present a special program in collaboration with the New York Times about bulletproofing your finances. And if you needed any more reason to do so, cast your mind back to just 2 weeks ago.
And Sandy is a superstorm.
60 million Americans will feel its power.
This storm is going to be destructive, historic, and unfortunately life-threatening.
Multiple states are now issuing state of emergency alerts, and for many, today is the calm before the storm.
This is our whole life, and it's here. How do we start over? It took 30 years to get our home. And now he retired, and we're in our 60s, and where do we go? How do we start to build a life all over again?
If you did not live through Hurricane Sandy and its aftermath, it's hard to fathom the extent of the destruction. Photos and videos go only so far. You simply cannot understand it if you haven't been through it. Unfortunately, plenty of Americans have been through it in one form or another, from natural disasters to man-made catastrophes like the financial crisis of 2008. Today, we'll talk about how to prepare yourself and prepare your finances as fully as possible with the help of our friends at the New York Times. Ron Lieber joins us now. He's the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. Glad to have you back on the program.
Always good to be here, Tess.
So it seems pretty appropriate that we are talking about security for your finances, given what's just been happening in your neighborhood.
Yeah, it's not like we planned it this way, Tess, but it turns out that many months ago when we all sat down together and decided that we wanted to do a special section and a broadcast on bulletproofing your finances, that we would be in a situation where, thousands of people in the tri-state area, here where I am, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, are without power, with homes that have been significantly damaged, cars that were underwater. The thing I think that people should think about there, right, is just because somebody isn't telling you or forcing you to buy certain kinds of insurance doesn't mean it might not be necessary. Maybe there's a case for purchasing a little more insurance than you need if you feel like there's a possibility that a storm that might not have reached you 10 or 20 years ago when the world looked a little different might well reach you in the next 10 to 20 years.
Well, as you mentioned early on in the planning process, you actually coined this phrase, bulletproofing your finances. And, disasters like Sandy aside, what are some of the other eventualities that we should all be preparing for and proofing our financial situations against?
One of the things that, I'm proudest of about this section is that we're addressing mental health, which, you may not think of as a financial issue necessarily. But, we've become more sophisticated as a society about acknowledging it and also in diagnosing and treating it. And undiagnosed mental health conditions can cost you a lot of money. It can affect your performance in the workplace or your ability to get a job in the first place. It can affect the kinds of financial decisions you're making. People with mental health issues can often oversave or radically undersave or get into terrible amounts of debt, depending on the condition. So I'm glad that we've got a piece in the section about mental health checkups. So we're sort of encouraging people that in the same way that you have a physical checkup, you ought to be finding a way to do a mental checkup.
Given all of the reporting that we are going to hear this hour, is it really possible to truly bulletproof yourself against disaster of all kinds?
You know, some stuff is fairly predictable, right? I mean, we do know that weather disasters seem to be happening with increasing frequency, and in some parts of the country, they are a regular occurrence. So, you know, you want to insure against the things that would be impossible to cover out of pocket. That's why I think, you know, everybody needs to take a second look at whether flood insurance is something that they may actually require. And, you know, another story that we have is about the importance of investing in stock. And, you know, so many people have decided or seem to have decided that, you know, they want nothing to do with the stock market anymore. Mm-hmm. But if you want to bulletproof yourself, you know, you need to be investing in assets that are going to deliver the kind of return that will allow you to have enough money when you retire. And if it's not going to be stocks, you need to be thinking about what else that is, or you need to be thinking about how it is that you're going to be able to continue working when you're 75 or 80.
Why do you think it is that we don't deal with a lot of these issues, that there's something in us that simply doesn't want to face the notion that this is going to happen to us?
I think one reason people avoid some of the tricky questions we're trying to raise in the section is because there are so many of them. Yeah. There are so many things that can go wrong. And it can be a little overwhelming to contemplate all of the potential perils that can befall one or one's family. But you've got to start somewhere, right? So even if it's, you know, only one or there are two of the things that, you know, we bring up here in the broadcast or that we bring up in the section, tackle it, you know, every 1 or 2 months and sort of cross it off your list, I think it really will help people feel better about where they stand.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, which is in partnership with us this weekend. Thanks so much, Ron.
Thank you, Tess.
Even today, you can stand on what passes for a hill in Joplin, Missouri's midsection at 23rd Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. Look east, look west, and see nothing but empty space. The trees are gone, apartment complexes are gone, the hospital is gone, the high school is gone. That's what happens when an EF5 tornado touches down, eviscerating everything in its path, as it did there on Sunday, May 22, 2011. 161 people died. As Joplin's residents make their way through the stages of grief, they want to share how they survived and how they're preparing for the next one.
Hi, Ray. Tess Viglin, nice to meet you.
Ray Freer was at her mother's home south of Joplin that Sunday afternoon. They were celebrating Mother's Day a week late.
And we were sitting in my parents' little breakfast nook, and my mother, who was close to 80, said, "That's the blackest cloud I've ever seen." And I looked at Fred, and he looked at me, and I thought, you know, I do not want to get this hair wet. Wasn't worried about the home. I was worried about the hair.
Ray, a 58-year-old teacher, and Fred, who was 60 and retired, left for home. When they got there, Fred stood in the road to check the sky, as he did every time a big storm came through town, until Ray called to him to get back in the house.
I was really excited because the very first time ever in 33 years of marriage that I asked him to come in, he actually came in.
He came in after seeing what was clearly not just another twister approaching the town. This looked and felt different. Once Fred was back in the house, he grabbed a twin mattress from one of the beds, and the two of them settled onto the floor of their small bathroom with the mattress on their heads.
My chest started getting tight, and my ears got tight, and all of a sudden they started popping. They must have popped hundreds of times. And I thought, Lord, what on earth am I going to do? This is serious. And it didn't sound like the tornado that had gone over my childhood home. That one sounded like a train. This sounded much more like World War III.
When the storm passed and the Freers emerged from their bathroom, they realized it was the only room still standing.
Stood up, opened the door, and realized I could see East Middle School and it had been destroyed. And I thought, oh, the poor school. I wonder if we'll have school tomorrow. And then realized I shouldn't be able to see the school.
The walls were gone. The roof was gone. The house was gone.
This blank property used to be your house.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing here now.
Right. 33 years.
You lived there for 33 years?
Mm-hmm. Almost.
So What's it like every time you come back here now?
Now it's just a piece of property. The first 6 months or so, it was a loss of memories.
But they'd lost more than memories. They'd lost a lifetime of things, wedding china, clothing, photos, all the accumulations of a household, many of them irreplaceable. And what was replaceable would cost them. But as Fred Freer noted, money issues take a back seat to the imminent possibility of death.
During all that, I never thought one thing about what we might be losing. I don't think through this whole thing that I've ever really worried about the financial part of it that much.
I don't think you can ever completely prepare financially for this, which doesn't mean you shouldn't be prepared, because we did what we could do.
But part of the reason they haven't worried more is that the Freers were more prepared than many of us are. And they give much of the credit to money guru Dave Ramsey and his Financial Peace University. Ramsey recommends always having $1,000 cash set aside where it's easily accessible. The Freers had that amount stashed in a safe in their bedroom closet. After the tornado, the closet wasn't there, but the safe was. Disaster preparedness experts say that is an important element of any emergency planning. Ted Beck is president of the National Endowment for Financial Education.
You can't really assume that you're going to have access to cash, especially if there's been something really significant like a major earthquake. The ATMs may not even be working.
But how much to have on hand? Beck suggests the same amount as emergency officials recommend for food and water, 3 days' worth. Those are the more immediate problems in the aftermath of a disaster. The longer-term issues and frustrations tend to revolve around insurance. And one bit of bureaucracy the Freers came up against was the demand for a list of the contents of their destroyed home, including what they paid for items, their current value, and their replacement value.
I did have a receipt box for a lot of major purchases, but what I didn't realize was how much all of these little things are. I have 16 T-shirts, or I have 22 pair of, you know, whatever.
And they wanted that level of
detail.
Yes,
yes.
And that receipt box for the bigger items? Gone with the wind.
I think it's in Illinois now. Maybe it was in Iowa.
Beck says without receipts, the best way to prove what you owned is with photos and videotape. Walk around your house and take a detailed inventory of what you own. Put it on a DVD or a thumb drive and keep it in a safe deposit box or in the cloud.
Don't step over there. There's a hole.
The Freers are now putting up a new house, less than a mile from the one that blew apart around them. Their insurance covered all but $30,000 for the rebuilding, so they are dipping into savings and retirement funds to get it finished. Contractors recently poured concrete nearly 18 months to the day after the tornado touched down.
I would say that this is an awfully nice outline of recovery and redemption.
I think you stated it very well, Tess. There are more things to be thankful here than we've lost.
We come from Pioneer stock, she said, so that's the way we want to live.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
The stock market crash of 2009 landed a lot of people in crisis. Investors, big and small, lost big chunks of money. And lots of folks said they were done with stocks altogether. As we know, share prices have largely rebounded, but an air of fear still holds some people back from re-entering the market. Russell Pearlman addresses this in his story, Investing While Terrified. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We heard a lot in the couple of years after, Dow 6500 that particularly the younger folks, folks in their 20s and early 30s, were saying, I'm never going to invest in stocks. Is it possible to see whether they have indeed followed up on that?
Well, you look at 401k participation among the 20-something set, and it is pretty high. Obviously, they're working off of a low base, so there's not a lot of money compared to the folks in their 40s and 50s. But the participation rate is actually pretty high for the 20-something set. And I think they've come to the realization that when you look around at the timeline that folks in their 20s and 30s have, that they don't have to worry about as much about the 2008 crash. Plus, if you lose 40% off of $1,000, but you're going to be investing for the next 40 years,
right,
you got a lot of time to make that up.
Well, for those who have quit stocks, where are they putting their money now? Are they putting it in those low-interest savings accounts, the CDs? Or are they buying gold bullion?
They're buying bonds of all forms. And to some extent, at least on the international side and the corporate side, that those can offer okay returns. But people going into U.S. Treasuries right now are really running the risk of not seeing their money go anywhere over the next several years because the Federal Reserve has made it quite clear they're going to keep interest rates really low. And then they also run the risk if inflation comes around. You know, you put in $1,000 and 5 years later, you have $1,200, but inflation has gone up a lot faster and you've actually lost ground, even though you think you've been a diligent investor. And they've also been going into gold and other commodities. A lot of people thought gold was the place for just crackpots about a decade ago. And then gold's price went up to $1,000 over there. And suddenly everyone's like, oh, we got to be in gold. But all the financial advisors that we seem to speak with are very much the, you know, gold should be as more of an insurance option in your portfolio. You don't want to overload it because gold as an investment is a very volatile commodity.
So the final message here is that it's not possible to bulletproof your stock portfolio, but there are ways to make it so that perhaps you can sleep better at night.
That's right. I mean, at least the good news is that the stock market right now is reasonably priced based on historic valuations. Corporate America also realizes that people need stocks as an investment and are giving folks incentive to buy their particular stock by raising dividends. And dividends are essentially just excess profits that the company has and says, you know what, we're going to give it to our shareholders every quarter. And at least for the moment, you have favorable tax treatment on those dividends. Obviously, there's a big caveat there, depending on
right, the fiscal cliff.
The fiscal cliff and any tax changes that might be having in 2013. But at least for the moment, you do have the tax advantage.
Russell Perlman, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
So as we noted, gold can certainly play a part in bulletproofing your portfolio, but it shouldn't be the end-all be-all. That said, there are plenty of so-called gold bugs out there hoarding sizable chunks of the precious metal, actual gold, not just gold-related funds. New York Times Wealth Matters columnist Paul Sullivan has that story.
When you think vault filled with gold, you might imagine Fort Knox or maybe Gringotts Wizarding Bank from Harry Potter.
Vault 687.
Dark and mysterious.
Lamp, please.
With elaborate locks.
Key, please.
The reality is a lot less glamorous.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hello.
My gold vault journey started in a rather plain office in a rather plain building in Midtown Manhattan.
Paul, P-A-U-L, Sullivan, S-U-L-L.
I had to hand over my wallet, jacket, cell phone, and my recording equipment. So you just have to take my word for what happened next. An elevator took us down to a sub-basement room. The vault itself was basically a cement box the size of a single-car garage. Imagine fluorescent lights, sheetrock walls, and gray metal shelves. On some, bags of gold coins. On others, single layers of gold bars the size of an iPhone. There was about $4 billion worth of gold around us, but it would all have fit in the back of any old SUV. Somehow, it was all a bit underwhelming until I picked up one of the bars. That's something. Dan Tapiero felt it too.
The first thing I was taken with was, wow, it's kind of cool. I didn't realize it was this shiny, this heavy.
Tapiero owns a gold investment company that stores some gold here. I talked to him in an unused vault on another floor.
I get it, meaning I get why it's been a powerful store of value for 5,000 years, because it's something that's rare, something that looks great, something that, you know, protects your savings.
Protecting savings was on Tapiero's mind after the 2008 global financial meltdown.
I thought, okay, what can I own that is not reliant upon this commercial banking system? and what can be held outside the system, and what can I do in enough size that it matters to me.
Tapiero's answer? Gold. He could have bought gold futures or stock in a mining company, but he wanted more than just a number flashing on a screen. He wanted the real thing. Tapiero's been a hedge fund manager for 20 years, so he knows people who know gold.
And I said, hey, you know, I'd like to buy a certain amount of physical gold. Can you do it for me? And my saleswoman said, well, you know, Dan, our limit is $20 million.
That's a $20 million minimum. Even for a hedge fund guy, that was a lot to spend. So he decided he'd create a company that would sell physical gold to the little guy. Well, not that little. Gold Bullion International's clients have a net worth anywhere from a couple hundred thousand to $25 million. And Tapiero got in the market at a great time. Since GBI started in 2009, gold's gone from about $900 an ounce to a high of $1,900 an ounce last summer. Tapiero believes it could go as high as $2,300 an ounce. He says there's a huge demand from emerging markets like China and India.
There's been a wealth transfer from Europe to the emerging world, which is what you would think would happen given the European crisis.
Lisa Shallett is a chief investment officer at Merrill Lynch's Wealth Management Group, which works with GBI. She says right now, people are worried about inflation, which drives down the value of currencies. That makes gold like an insurance policy.
So when the market believes that inflation is going to go up in the future, the price of gold tends to go up. Similarly, when they think that the value of the U.S. dollar is going to go down, the price of gold goes up.
Gold's a good hedge, in other words. But Shallett says investors shouldn't expect it to act like stocks or bonds.
Gold, like other precious metals, are somewhat unique in that they're kind of coveted for their store of wealth, but they actually don't create wealth. And it's simply the supply and demand for gold itself that kind of creates its own market.
Shallett says Merrill Lynch recommends clients who can afford to put 3 to 5% of their assets in the shiny stuff. Today, a quarter of Dan Tapiero's net worth is in gold. At that rate, you could mistake him for a gold bug. One of those people hoarding gold coins and canned food in case of the apocalypse. That's not how he sees it.
It'll be good to have physical gold if everything happens except the end of the world.
In which case, it probably won't matter much if the vault is not quite as glamorous as the ones in the movies. I'm Paul Sullivan for Marketplace.
Any discussion of crisis has to, by its nature, address death. The passing of a loved one creates obvious emotional crises for a family, but it can also fuel a financial crisis, especially if there is no will. Laura Holson writes about this in our Times collaboration. Hi, Laura.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. What prompted you to write this piece?
A lot of my friends have really tried to figure out how to write their wills, and it became this big drama of, oh my God, I'm going to die. This is terrible. And I started thinking about, what does this really mean? And when you look at it the way that I did, which is like, hey, you can, you know, give gifts in the afterlife, it became not so stressful.
Yeah, you actually asked your friends and family what things of yours they wanted after you passed, and that must have been slightly awkward.
It was totally awkward, but at the beginning. But then when I kind of explained to them, you know, hey, I really like you. And, you know, if I happen to die before you do, there may be something you want. And let's just be open and discuss it instead of me trying to kind of throw darts as to who wants what. And I figured there had to be something they wanted to remember me by.
Well, you know, we hear from listeners all the time who have not thought about a will or anything else preparing until a major life event happens. Why had you not thought about this until now? And if I may ask, how old are you?
Yeah, I'm 50 this year. And I hadn't really thought about it because I'm single. And, you know, how this kind of all started, this friend and I were discussing it. And she said, you know what? You don't have to be fair. You're single. You can give it to whoever you want. And that kind of got me on this path of really thinking about what I wanted people to have to remember me by.
Well, when you spoke with experts about making a living will, putting your end-of-life wishes in writing, are there some general tips that you can share with our listeners?
Know exactly what you want and communicate with, you know, whoever it is that's going to be in charge of that. It's funny, a lot of this came from talking to my doctor and to one of the people who, you know, I've given kind of authority if something happens to me. I just was really blunt about it. I'm like, if, you know, I'm brain dead, can you bluntly pull the plug? Mm-hmm. That was a conversation my mom and I had about, could you make a difficult decision?
And that's called an advanced medical directive.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you. I think it's important to have that conversation because if they can't do it or they don't want to, like, why would I make somebody do that? You know, if somebody has issues with death, I'm not going to make it hard for them. But in communicating what I want, look, if I'm sick and I don't know what's going on, they're going to do what they think is right, but hopefully it'll be what I think is right because I've communicated.
When we're talking about, you know, preparing for financial crisis, what do you think the crisis is potentially if you don't do this sort of thing?
You have a lot of legal implications. I mean, in my case, when I was looking at it before I started, if I died without a will, everything would have gone to my parents first, but, you know, they were both dead. And from then it would have gone to my brothers and sisters. And there were certain things that I wanted to go to people other than my brothers and sisters, although I liked them very well. And I didn't really want, you know, the state to step in or somebody else to step in and tell me what I wanted. I wanted to take charge and do what I wanted. And the way that you do that is just by writing a will.
Laura Holson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Drive just about anywhere around Joplin, Missouri on a Sunday morning with the windows rolled down, and you know where to find a good percentage of its population. This is a city of churchgoers in the heart of America's Bible Belt, and there is widespread agreement that for all the destruction wrought on May 22nd of last year, God spared this community even worse pain. Michael and Tabitha Davison, members of this, the South Joplin Christian Church on Pearl Avenue, believe God spared them. But an argument can be made that their own foresight did that as well.
So I was making hot dog sauce, and I told my son, I said, is there anything on the radar? And I kept telling him, is there anything on the radar? And he's on the computer, and he's like, no, Dad, there's nothing on the radar. I was like, okay.
That night, Michael Davison was at a home south of the tornado's path with their 15-year-old son and a youth group from the church where he works as a custodian. Tabitha, who teaches at a religious private school, was at home directly in the tornado's path. She was working on a plumbing problem, a shower head that had leaked the entire decade since they bought the house just before September 11th, 2001.
I mentioned that as an important detail. We moved into the house with a tragedy, and we left the house with a tragedy.
Joplin's warning sirens first sounded around 5:10 p.m. Tabitha says she didn't hear them. About 10 minutes later, they sounded again. She looked out the window and didn't see anything, but decided to move with her 12-year-old daughter, Emma, to the laundry room.
And I just said, you know what, just for fun, why don't you get in the hope chest that Grandma gave us at Christmas that had been in our family for generations and had been passed down to her. And she...
was like, why are we taking cover for fun? Tornadoes are serious, Mom.
So she gets her stuffed animals and her iPod and gets into the box.
Tabitha sat down next to the hope chest, placed her hand inside to keep contact with her daughter, and hoped for the best. And then the tornado was on them.
It just was crazy. It wasn't like a train. Trains are nothing compared to the sound. You hear this ferocious thing just hitting your house, and you start then to feel the walls moving. We were praying the Lord's Prayer. It sounds melodramatic now because we were not injured in any way, but at that time I faced my death and possibly the death of my child.
When the storm passed, they emerged to find a living room that opened to the sky and a second-story staircase to nowhere.
And my first thought was, God is so good. And that's what I said. I said, God is so good because our house is destroyed, but we're okay. And the other thing I said was, looks like we're going to have quite a decorating project over the summer. Little did I know.
They're able to laugh now, 18 months later, in part because of the quick recovery afforded them by earlier decisions about insurance. Tabitha Davison's mother had always told her to get replacement cost insurance, as opposed to what's known as an actual cash value payment. It's more expensive, but it covers whatever it costs to buy everything new, including the house and all your belongings. They also had something called an inflation guard on their policy. It automatically adjusted to cover increases in rebuilding costs. They had all those protections because after discovering a coverage discrepancy in a previous policy, they changed insurance companies.
Every year, when you get that giant packet of legalese, you better read every page. You've got to take responsibility and read that paperwork and make sure that you're still covered at the level you thought you were covered when you started.
Their policy also included $10,000 worth of debris removal and demolition costs. Because their insurance was so comprehensive, 6 weeks after the storm, they had a check in hand to cover the outstanding mortgage balance on the destroyed home, as well as the full cost of a new one. Aside from getting insurance and making sure you check it every year, Davison had one other piece of practical advice.
I would say if you're going to put together a kit, one thing that would be really good to have is just the names of your prescriptions and what and the milligrams that you're taking.
And indeed, that was one common issue faced by many Joplin residents. Stephanie Brady, vice chair of Joplin's long-term recovery committee, noted that many pharmacies, including the local Walmart, were damaged or destroyed.
That was one of the big expenses that people had is their pharmacy's gone, they've lost their prescriptions are expensive, and they couldn't get a new prescription or an actual script for that, let alone have the money to purchase that again.
Tabitha Davison wishes they'd thought to put on shoes as the storm approached, and that will be a priority next time. And there may well be a next time, because they still live in Joplin, not far from their old house. They also now have a fire-safe box containing important household documents. They check their insurance documents every year. They've got a plan. But even had they done all that before May 22, 2011, they say no plan would have been sufficient for what happened that evening. And they know they were lucky.
The house is destroyed. Oh, well. The van is destroyed. Oh, well. We have insurance.
Yeah.
Who cares about stuff? Yeah. You can't replace people. You can replace your stuff.
Yeah.
We all know that regular checkups are a good idea to keep tabs on what's going on with our bodies, our weight, our blood pressure, our reflexes. But what about our minds? Common mental disorders like depression and anxiety can be more difficult to manage the longer they go unnoticed, and having these disorders can affect decisions we make about finances and family. Times reporter Ann Carnes joins us now to talk about the importance of mental health checkups. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Very well, thank you. In part due to the fact that I get regular checkups. We're all familiar with the concept of a periodic physical, but is there such a thing as a mental health checkup?
The idea of a mental health checkup is less well known, even though in speaking with various psychiatrists, they all think it's a pretty good idea because these conditions are highly treatable, especially when they are identified in the early stages before they get so severe that they might precipitate some sort of personal or even perhaps leading to a financial crisis if you had to take time off of work.
Why is this not a regular occurrence as part of our overall health care?
Historically, health plans have tended to offer less robust mental health benefits. And so maybe people have been reluctant to seek care because they couldn't afford it. That's starting to change. There's a new federal rule about mental health parity, which means that large health plans in particular have to offer similar levels of coverage if they offer mental health benefits. They can't charge higher co-pays for mental health visits, and they can't set unreasonable limits on the coverage.
You touched on this already, but can you talk about the correlation between someone's mental health and the kinds of financial decisions that they make or don't make?
One of the symptoms of a common disorder like depression or anxiety is difficulty making decisions. So you might find it difficult to focus on making financial decisions or sort of assimilating all the information that you need to make a good decision.
Do you have to go to a doctor to gauge whether you're in good mental health?
There isn't necessarily a need for a specific visit just to have your mental health tune-up, as it were. But it should really come up as a normal part of your regular wellness visit. The doctor should be asking you about your mental health as well as your blood pressure or your weight, et cetera. it's a good idea to educate yourself about possible symptoms that might indicate a problem so that you can raise the issue with your doctor when you go in.
Why is this a crisis? Or is it more that not doing a mental health checkup could be a crisis?
It's the latter. The idea that to fend off a potential crisis that might put you in a position where you were in financial distress because you couldn't handle your job, or if you were having a mental disorder like depression or anxiety that made it difficult for you to focus or was interfering with your job, that could precipitate a financial crisis. So the thinking here is by keeping regular tabs on your emotional well-being, you know, periodically, that you're less likely to end up in a situation where you might have a severe disorder that would lead you to hospitalization or a disability that might cause you to miss work.
Ann Carnes of the New York Times, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
And now a story, a somewhat complicated one about an all-too-common crisis, an elderly person whose life savings are on the line. Anna Mae Franklin learned about all this the hard way. She's been caring for her 91-year-old brother, Arthur Cropsey, for the past couple of years. He suffers from dementia. Within a few months of Anna Mae moving Arthur into her home, she discovered some of his money was missing, and she believed her daughter was responsible. Anna Mae lives with her two small dogs in a mobile home just north of Albany, New York.
My name is Anna Mae Franklin. I live in the town of Colony for 70-some years. I am 83 years old. Came from a family of seven children, and they've all passed on except my brother Arthur and myself. I had been calling my brother, and he wouldn't answer the phone. In 2009, he kept hanging up on me. So on December the 7th of 2010, I called his neighbor, and his neighbor said, "You must have had ESP because your sister-in-law died this morning." I got out there, and my daughter was with me, and we got to his house. We knocked and knocked, and finally he came. So I said to him, "Do you know who I am?" And he said, "Yeah, you're my sister Annie." And then the doctors start coming in, and they said he has the starting of Alzheimer's. There was a mess of bills and checks and everything. So we took all these checks that came in, dividends and stuff, and we went to the bank with it. And I said, "We want to put this in my brother's account because they're laying in the house. His wife died, so he isn't going to be staying here. We're going to New York State." He says, "Okay, that's easily done." And he left, and he came back, and he had the whole statement there. He hands it to my daughter instead of me. In the meantime, Linda looks at this and she goes, "Ooh!" And I didn't even question anything about it afterwards. I just wanted to get back to New York State with him. I had a checkbook that I brought some money up from California and put it in the bank, and it had my name and my brother Art's name on it. It was for doctor bills, hospital bills, medication, anything pertaining to my brother. So she said to me, "Mom, you better put my name on the checkbook, because if I take him to the doctors, then I got to have a check. She's my daughter. I trust her." Well, she said, "I have another thought. Instead of the check, get me a debit card. Then I don't have to bother you at all." They used that debit card every place they went, and they spent $71,000 of my brother's money. And when I called my daughter, I said to her, "Linda, what are you doing with the money?" She said, "Are you accusing me?" I never heard from her again. I don't know if she sits and thinks of what she has done, but she's got to be numb if she doesn't.
Anna Mae's daughter, Linda, repaid thousands of dollars, and a judge said she had manipulated her uncle. For more information about protecting yourself and loved ones from elder financial abuse, go to marketplace.org. If there's one singular thing that could prepare you for a financial crisis, it's, everybody with me now,
emergency fund!
Emergency fund!
If we've said it once, we've said it, 94,000 times. It is not for a rainy day. It's for when you lose your job or you suddenly have a giant medical bill that insurance won't cover or a tornado takes your house. So maybe a better name for it is an uncertainty fund. Our good friend, financial advisor, and napkin artist Carl Richards wrote about this recently in the New York Times. Welcome back.
Happy to be here, Tess. Thank you.
So why are we calling this an uncertainty fund instead of an emergency fund?
My thought was the term emergency fund was generic and had the standard rules of thumb that apply to it. Like you're supposed to have, you know, anywhere from 2 to 12 months of money set aside.
Right.
And I thought we just needed to look at this in a new angle. Where is the uncertainty lie in your life? Where's risk coming from?
Hmm.
We used to think of the people who would lose their jobs as those crazy entrepreneurs starting businesses. Well, we all know that's changed, right? You can find yourself unemployed at a moment's notice. So what type of uncertainty do you have in your life? Should have an impact on the sort of size of your uncertainty fund, right? Like if your life is very stable, you've got this business that you've built that's really stable, or this career you feel is really stable, maybe your uncertainty fund doesn't need to be as big as somebody who takes a lot of risk in their professional life.
There are a lot of folks out there, I think, who want to be responsible, want to have this uncertainty fund. But quite frankly, whenever we talk about it on air, about saving in any way, shape, or form, they say, look, I can't. I can't set anything aside. Stop telling me that I have to do this because I'm living from paycheck to paycheck. What's the answer to that?
The idea of having, right, 6 months of your salary in your emergency fund, sometimes that can feel overwhelming. So yeah. I think it's just important for us to stop and take a big breath and say, okay, what can we do? Maybe find some income on the side. Maybe pick up an extra shift at work and set it aside, even if it's, you know, cash in the mason jar underneath the bed.
Yeah.
And what I've found is as soon as we get some plan to make progress, we start to feel better. And that starts to build on itself. And it starts this wonderful cycle of good feelings about money instead of bad.
That sounds a lot easier, though, than I think it is for people. How do you take that first step to step back?
I think we've got to get to the point where we realize, look, the best we can do is the best we can do. Put on our no blame, no shame hats and realize nothing's going to change until we sort of face up to our own situation and start just saying, okay, is there one little thing we can do this month different than we did last month?
And there's nothing too little.
Totally. I mean, you think about I'm thinking about a long bike race I used to do that was 206 miles. If you thought at the beginning of that, man, I'm going to be on my bike for 12 hours or 10 hours and it's 206 miles, and you thought about that every single mile, you would never, ever, and we've all heard the story, right? You eat an elephant one bite at a time. That's my point, is we've all got to have some emergency plan, some uncertainty plan, hopefully to build up this fund.
Carl Richards. You can find his article about the Uncertainty Fund at the New York Times Bucks blog. He is also Director of Investor Education at the BAM Alliance. Thanks so much, Carl.
Thank you, Tess.
39-year-old Carrie Cook has a brand new house in Joplin, Missouri. From the property, you can look east or west and still see miles of empty land created by the tornado.
This is Kentucky, and the next street over is Grand, and that's where they're going to be building the new high school. As you look down the hill, you see the steeple there. That's one of our churches that was taken out. It's just gotten rebuilt. And on the other side of there was a huge apartment complex, which is where we lived during the storm.
Cook works in the advertising department for the local cable company. She was supposed to be at her apartment cleaning on that Sunday evening in May of last year. Instead, she'd driven to her mother's house for dinner with her 9-year-old son, Zachary. As they arrived, the sirens blew. Minutes later, Cook's ex-husband drove up with their other son, 7-year-old Aiden.
He said, everybody get into my car, and he told my mom, you're coming too. And so we grabbed the dog, and then he drove to my dad's house. And as we were going into my dad's storm shelter, the fence and everything was coming down. So we were right in the midst of it. Basically, everything happened instantaneously.
After the tornado passed, Carrie's father and ex-husband went to check on her apartment. The top floor of the two-story complex was sheared away. Their first floor apartment was uninhabitable.
The boys' rooms and the kitchen was completely gone. I mean, so all of that had to walk.
There was a dumpster in our living room.
You see the front of the building, but the back of the building was just gone.
Cook says the calculation of what this could do to their finances began the moment she saw the destruction.
All that processing and panic started that night. I couldn't sleep. Once I got the kids laid down and sleeping, I immediately went into panic mode.
She didn't work for 3 weeks after the storm because the boys' daycare had no electricity. The apartment complex they lived in was federally subsidized housing. For the first few nights after the storm, they stayed in hotels, courtesy of her mom's employer, and after that, a succession of apartments. Her saving grace? Renter's insurance.
And a lot of people around here didn't have it, but I did have renter's insurance and I had full coverage on my car, even though it was paid for. I got my first check probably within 5 days. I wouldn't have a couch. I wouldn't have TV. I wouldn't have any of that stuff if I didn't have the insurance money.
A recent survey by the Insurance Information Institute showed less than a third of all renters in the United States purchase renter's insurance. That's despite owning an average $30,000 worth of household goods. The average cost of insuring that amount of property is about $12 a month. You heard Cook mention there that she also had full coverage on her car instead of just liability, even though it was paid off. Stephanie Brady with Joplin's Long-Term Recovery Committee says lack of adequate coverage was a huge issue for lower-income families. 18,000 vehicles were damaged or destroyed, and public transport wasn't available for 2 weeks after the storm.
A lot of people lost their jobs because they couldn't get to their job because they didn't have that transportation. So for a lot of people, it just compounded. And then because of those money issues, you know, losing your job, losing your transportation, losing your housing, we've had a lot of people who've faced depression, not having the finances, not being able to support their family.
Like the Freers, who we heard from earlier in the show, Cook is a follower of finance guru Dave Ramsey. Because of that, she did have some cash set aside, hidden in a piece of furniture in her apartment. That was one piece that was still intact after the storm came through. It wasn't a lot, but at that point, every dollar was helpful. And she says she was able to get through her first few months in large part because of the kindness of strangers.
People from everywhere donated money. I mean, they'd hand you a Bible and it'd have $20 in it. They would just come up to you and give you gift cards.
Cook and her sons recently moved into one of 65 homes being built by Habitat for Humanity this year in Joplin, part of a vibrant construction boom that's going on all over her neighborhood and others. She says getting the house was a work of God. Habitat even built them an underground storm shelter, so she and the boys have some place to escape to when the next tornado comes. All proof, she says, that some measure of good can come from disaster.
We have been truly blessed. We never would have had a house had the storm not come. We try to look at the storm as a turning point in our lives. Not the happiest day of our lives, but it was a major turning point for my family because we wouldn't have this.
I'm hijacking your broadcast.
Okay, what are you doing here, Patty?
Well, Tess, as most of our listeners know, after 6 years at the helm of Marketplace Money, this is your last show. Now, we still have Ron Lieber of the New York Times on the line with us, so I thought that together we could celebrate your time at Marketplace and that we should talk a little bit about what you've achieved and how you feel about that.
You're not going to put this on the air.
Ron, tell me, how long have you known Tess?
I've been lucky enough to know Tess since we started this partnership a couple of years ago, though I feel like I've known her forever.
As you know, Ron, periodically we award the Marketplace Piggy Award. So I thought that today we'd present that award to Tess. So I have one here, which is signed by all of the Marketplace Money staff. Tess, this is to you.
Don't do this to me.
From us and also from all of the staff at the New York Times, thank you for being such a paragon of personal finance and for your great service to Marketplace and to Marketplace Money. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tess.
Thanks, you guys. Somebody get me a tissue. Boink, boink.
Thank you.
that is Marketplace Money for this week. Share your thoughts about this special at marketplace.org. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Special thanks to our collaborators at the New York Times. This special hour was produced by Devin Maverick Robbins and Patty Hirsch. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.